Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome back to the Intercooler Podcast, everybody. And also welcome back to us, because we're back after taking a summer break. We were off last week. There wasn't an episode of the podcast, but we are back now. And I suppose the nature of taking a week off during Monterey Car Week is that there's an awful lot of car news happening while we're away. So that's what we're going to do with this episode, is just catch up on some of the bits and pieces that have happened. Before we get started, though, Andrew, we have a new jingle. So I just played it at the start of the podcast there. I think it's quite good, isn't it? We had a jingle in the Drive Nation days, but we haven't had one since we changed to the intercooler. So thank you to Stephen Harrington, who cut together that jingle for us. And I will just give him a plug, because it was very good of him. If you need a jingle, or if you're looking for a podcast producer, give Stephen Harrington a shout. I'll put his email address in the description of this podcast as well. So we're back after a week away. I suppose the big news is that there is a new Lamborghini Countach, which is actually, it's an amazing, I didn't think I'd ever say that, but I can tell by the face you're pulling that you're not necessarily behind. Okay, hang on, I just want to get your initial thoughts, and then we'll talk about all the specifics. But initial thoughts, you're not so keen.
Well, I don't know where to begin. I don't have a problem with car manufacturers producing cars that their customers want to buy. And I've read a lot of stuff about how cynical it is and that sort of thing. And a lot of comments like that have been applied to a lot of other cars, which I've not been overtly critical of. But I just don't think they've done it very well. I mean, okay, so there are two fundamental points to this. Firstly, I don't think that great design ever looks back. You know, you think of the greatest design cars that there have ever been, from, I don't know, on one particular level, a Mini or an E-Type Jaguar, a McLaren F1. Wherever you go in history, you know, name a car. I mean, people will say, well, you know, the new Fiat 500, but people only like the design of that because it's based on something else. So fundamentally, I think when you go down that road, maybe there's a conversation to be had about the Alpine here, but I think it is different, because the A110 is clearly, I mean, I don't think it's as good looking at cars as the original. I think very few cars are, but I think what it is doing is acknowledging the original car. It's not, you know, trying to completely and utterly, well, copy is probably too strong a word, but to be a modern recreation of it by getting as close to its styling cues as possible, which is what this new Countach seems to be doing. And that's my problem. It's not so much that they've gone down the retro thing. I just don't think it looks very good. It looks like a sort of a modern kit car designer's interpretation of a Countach. And when you are dealing with, I mean, I don't actually, I really, really admired Marcello Gandini for doing the original Countach. I thought it was an amazing looking car. For me, of the supercars of those eras, because I like sort of more sculptural design, you know, I think a Ferrari Boxer or even a Maserati Bora is a technically more beautiful car than a Countach. But there's no doubting at all that the original Countach, particularly the early cars, and, you know, the 1971 concept, most of all, is an absolutely iconic piece of design. And I can use that word in that context, because I genuinely think if ever there was a supercar iconic piece of design, it is the Countach. And I think that you revisit that at your peril, because what you're saying is, well, here we are 50 years down the road, and with all we've learned, you know, we're frankly arrogant enough to think that we can do that better. It's like someone coming along and trying to remake Psycho or something like that. Some, you know, some absolutely extraordinary piece of cinema, which at the time people go put on a pedestal and just go, well, you know, let's not visit that again, because how do you make it any better? And I feel the same way about this. I think they'd set themselves up for a fall, because I can't really imagine how they could do that and come out with something where we all go, oh, wow, that's actually, you know what? That actually does justice to the original design, let alone do better. So, yeah, it's not so much what they've done for me as the way they've done it. And I obviously haven't seen the car. Nobody's seen the car unless you've been over there. So, you know, hopefully I will at some stage get to see it. I don't imagine after this I'll get to drive it. But, you know, sometimes cars look different in the flesh to how they look in the photograph. So I will reserve final judgment until then. But from what I've seen so far, it looks a bit amateurish. And I think if ever there were a car which doesn't deserve to have that happen to it, it's the original Countach. There you go.
Well, that is crystal clear. Yeah, okay. I find that fairly difficult to argue with. So the whole point of this is that it was 50 years ago this year, in 1971 at the Geneva Motor Show, that the original Lamborghini Countach was shown, the prototype, the show car. I really loved that on the Intercooler app, the day after this new Countach was unveiled, we published a story by Mel Nichols, which is all about driving in an original Countach prototype in 1973 with Bob Wallace, the test driver. I just thought that was a nicely timed bit of TI iconoclasm. You know, I just thought that was, you know, this is what we do. Everyone else is talking about this, but come over here, we're talking about this, and it's more fun. Hopefully someone else got a kick out of that as well. But okay, let's talk about this new car, because I suppose it's the way of the world these days, but ultimately it's an Aventador underneath. It has the Aventador chassis and underpinnings, but it's got the drivetrain from the Cian, so it's the naturally aspirated 6.5-litre V12, yeah, with the little electric motor and the supercapacitor. So it's about 800 horsepower. 30 horsepower or so from the electric motor. So it's four-wheel drive, still has that robotized manual gearbox, of course. 0 to 62 in 2.8, 220 miles an hour, around £2 million. It's
112 cars at £2 million each. Does that not strike you as being quite ambitious?
But it's got the name, though, hasn't it? Countach. If any name's going to sell, I suppose it's that one.
It's interesting. I mean, the Countach and Harry Metcalf, if you're listening to this, as a Countach owner, I would love to hear your view on it. You say it's got the name. I think it does have the name. The Countach is, but I mean, Lamborghinis have. Just talking generally here, Lamborghinis have not been as collectible as Ferraris. And they don't have that sort of design longevity. I think it's because Ferrari raced, and Ferrari's perceived has an authenticity surrounding it, because it started as a race team and has always been one, whereas Lamborghini never was. So I'll be really, really interested. And also, you know, the marketplace, it's crowded, isn't it, with cars, you know, with £2 million, you know, hypercars. You know, so many people, you know, and I guess there are a number of people who that sum of money is not important, and they'll just tick every box and they'll have everyone because they can't bear the idea of not having one. But I just wonder, I mean, I suppose I can, and I may be completely wrong about this, but I can see a bunch of people thinking to themselves, I must have the latest Ferrari hypercar, I must have the latest McLaren hypercar, maybe even the next Porsche hypercar, because these are iconic brands, and I would never want to fall off the list because I am part of a legacy, I'm part of a heritage, which I just don't, for me, I just don't see Lamborghini having, and maybe people may not feel quite so desperate to part with a couple of million quid for a Lamborghini in the way that they might for a McLaren or a Ferrari. I don't know. Maybe that's just my hideous prejudice, but I'll be interested to see. It's a lot of cars for £2 million.
Yeah.
It really is, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I suppose we'll find out, won't we? And if they come out in a few months' time and say, oh, to increase exclusivity, we've decided we're only going to do 48, then we'll know, won't we? But, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, except they've tied themselves in a knot, haven't they? Because it's the LP112. The LP112 was the original product designation of the original Countach. So they can't reinvent that, can they? They can't sort of say, oh, well, actually, we found the prototype of the prototype, and that was the LP48. So
they're bound to it now, aren't they? And they might start discounting them or giving, you know, bog off offers or something. But I remember being at the Bahrain Grand Prix circuit a couple of years ago when they launched the Huracan Evo. And Stefano Domenicali was there. He was still Lamborghini CEO, I think, at the time. And I sat down with him one-on-one and just had a chat. And I said to him, would Lamborghini ever revive an old nameplate or, you know, come up with some sort of recreation? Because it seems to me that Lamborghini, certainly relative to most other supercar companies, is the one that hasn't lent on its heritage or, you know, trawled up old names from the past. And Domenicali said Lamborghini would do something special for the anniversary of one of its iconic cars. And he didn't say any more than that. That's all he said. But this must have been what he was talking about.
Interesting.
And I suppose it was.
Interesting. Sorry, they didn't do it in 2016 for the Miura. You know, to me, a Miura is a more, if I can use that word again, iconic car than even a Countach. Because it was so groundbreaking and so beautiful. And they didn't decide to do it. I don't know. I mean, they do use bits of their old name. You know, they still call things SVs and SVJs and all that sort of
LPs.
I mean, and that all goes back to, you know, Muras and goodness knows what. So, but no, is this the first time they've actually come up with a car with the same actual name as one of its predecessors? I can't think of another, certainly.
I think it is. Yeah, I think it is. I suppose it was inevitable that they'd do something like this eventually. But I'm like you. I haven't seen it in the flesh. Looking at it in pictures, I think it looks okay. Maybe it'll look absolutely sensational when you see one in person, but I don't know. That would be a surprise. Okay, well, let's keep talking about outrageously expensive hypercars. We'll just whistle through the Bugatti Bolide quickly, because we spoke about it when they unveiled the sort of concept thing back in October. They have now decided to put it into low volume production. They'll build 40 cars. It's a track car, €4 million each. And it looks like a Le Mans car. It's, you know, it doesn't have the sort of volume, the shape and the scale and the size of a conventional road car. It looks like a competition car.
But this is like their sort of spoiler for the Valkyrie, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it's their retort, isn't it? Although I don't think it's road legal. So it is quite different in that regard. And it's still got the W16 quad turbo engine, 1,600 odd horsepower on 98 octane fuel and a race fuel.
But Aston Martin are doing 40 Valkyrie AMR Pros, aren't they?
That's true. Yeah, so it's a sort of direct competitor for that. I suppose they've seen the likes of Ferrari come up with these track-only cars, sell a bunch of them to, you know, their best customers and earn a load of revenue. This Bolide is 1,450 kilograms with fluids, something like 600 kilos lighter than a Chiron. And it's also therefore got more brake horsepower than kilograms. So it's got a
1,000 sort of horsepower
over positive power to weight ratio. It's going to be spectacular, I'm sure.
That is going to be absolutely nuts. I have driven one or two cars that do that. They're just animals. They're barely controllable. I mean, if you a sort of late 70s, early 80s Formula One car will do that, 500 kilos, 500 horsepower. They're just absolutely ridiculous. 1450. So how have they managed to
get
that?
That seems a lot, doesn't it? I don't know if it's based on the Chiron or not. I actually don't know about the underpinnings, or is it a ground up car? Because it doesn't look like it shares anything with
if you can get anything that packages that powertrain into a car for 1450 kilos, then fair play. I mean, I imagine it's completely stripped out and everything else, but fair enough.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah. I mean, it's a hell of a lot heavier than a Valkyrie, for instance. Not got a W16 engine. I've mentioned the Valkyrie, so let's just move on to that, because, I mean, this is quite interesting. I don't think too many of us saw this coming, but I think you wrote a piece for the Intercooler about the Valkyrie Spider, which was, again, announced last week. 85 cars, more than £3 million, all sold out. And actually, as you see it and as you reported it, Aston Martin had to do this.
Yeah, I mean, it was... I think it was a bit of a slam dunk no-brainer for them, to be honest. As I said in the piece, I know that Aston Martin regretted pitching the price of the Valkyrie so low, £2.5 million. I mean, it's ridiculous even having this conversation, doesn't it? But nevertheless, it sold so fast, and they suddenly thought, we could have sold a stack more of these. They'd said what they said about how many they're going to build, and rightly stuck to that. And then, out goes the old guard, in comes Tobias, who goes, well, they were coupes, so there's nothing to stop us doing some spiders. And, the car is different. It has different aero. It has, obviously, the tub is slightly different because the doors now are dihedral, so they flip up. They're not the old gullwing doors, but it's pretty much... a very straightforward thing. I mean, to the extent that, they've not found anywhere to put the roof. So if you want to take the roof off, you have to leave it at home, or maybe stick it in the Range Rover with whoever it is charging along after you with your luggage. There were so many people who wanted a Valkyrie who didn't get one. Now they can have one. I spoke to somebody at Aston Martin. I said, surely you must have really, really pissed off a load of Valkyrie owners who thought that they were buying into something that they were only going to be, 125, 150 cars? Can't remember.
150, I think. Yeah.
150, yes. I've been away for a week and my mind's not functioning. But whatever it is, and then suddenly you're going to be doing more than half as many again, diluting that exclusivity. And the line is, on the contrary... more than a few of them were very happy to have the opportunity to have both. There must be some who are cheesed off, though. There must be.
I'm sure there must be. Yeah. Yeah. Suddenly there are significantly more Valkyries on the road than they thought there would be. Some will be cheesed off. There's no question. But, the Spider will generate something like another quarter of £1 billion in revenue. And I suppose someone, perhaps Tobias, has looked at it and gone, well, this car is once in a generation. We're just not going to do anything like this anytime soon again.
Yeah.
And this one really has to work.
We can't really afford not to do it. Particularly if, as I've also heard, the Valkyrie has been a great sort of halo car for the brand, but it's not been a profit centre at all. I mean, I've heard that, it's not a moneymaker at all. Now, if this makes it a moneymaker, then... Then great. Good luck to them.
Mm. Yeah, they had this incredible asset in the Valkyrie. All that engineering that's gone into it, all the coverage and all the chatter and all the noise surrounding it, and they've really got to capitalise on that. I think fair play to them. And a few cheesed off coupe owners, so be it. Before we move on any further, I just want to jump in with an extract from a TI Super podcast. TI Super podcasts are for app subscribers only. So if you want to listen to them, you have to go and download the app and subscribe. £5 a month to do so, by the way. Go and do it now. And on the TI Super podcast, rather than me and Andrew shouting at one another, we we actually talk to guests. And we've had some good guests on there already, actually. You, for instance, sat down with the CEO of Ford, Jim Farley, for what he described was his best interview ever. It was really good. It was really interesting. And this one, Matt Windle didn't say this was his best interview ever, sadly. I was upset about that. But I sat down with him at Goodwood. He's the MD of Lotus Cars. And it was a good time to sit down and talk to him because, I mean, Lotus is just going through a proper renaissance at the moment. And he's the man tasked with making the most of it. They've got new backing, new support, proper funding. They've got a long-term vision and strategy. And it's his job to, you know, roll that strategy out. And so we spoke Emira, we spoke Evija, and we also spoke about Lotus in sort of top-line motorsport. Does Lotus need to be involved in top-line motorsport? So let me just play a few minutes of that for you now. Last time I was at Hethel, it was a few years ago, and I was just remembering this with Gav Kershaw earlier. I was driving around the track itself through that quick corner, Windsock, and that was at the time where you still had to judge, you had to avoid a pothole when you were coming flying out of that corner. I hear things are different now.
Yeah, I got to be honest, I quite like the I quite like the track because it put a bit of jeopardy in there if you were going around Windsock Corner, didn't it? But no, it's completely resurfaced now. You can go around there very safely, but still quick. But the infrastructure in the whole place. I mean, love you to come down as soon as you can, so that you can see the changes have gone in. But built two new factories, put a new restaurant in, all of the sites done, signage, all the protection for the staff, all of those things have gone in. Infrastructure as well that you can't see, IT infrastructure. We had to put a high voltage ring around the site because we didn't have enough power. All of those things that are just not sexy, but when you want to treble your production on site, they're the things you have to invest in. So we're really pleased with it. It's as it should be. I mean, Lotus for me, as you know, I was there and I went away, the Tesla, and I came back. And when I came back, I walked around for the first time, and it's always been a proper car company there. Always. It's had the people, it's had the facilities, it's got the track, it's got the history, it's got the engineering knowledge. It just didn't have the strategy or the investment in the place. So now it's got that. We should be on our way, really.
And if you want to listen to the full thing, it's on the Intercooler app. And we're going to keep doing these TI Super podcasts for app subscribers only. We've got another one coming up with a proper, I'm going to use that word, I'm afraid, legend of Le Mans racing, certainly, Richard Attwood. That is on its way. But let's get back to it then. I just want to talk to you about one thing that you got up to last week, Andrew, which was going to Loch Ness. You weren't looking for any monsters, as I understand it, but you were looking at a memorial to one John Cobb.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated, literally since I was a kid, fascinated with the land speed record. You know, I can just about remember Gary Gabelich blasting across the desert in his Blue Flame rocket car in 1970. I think he did 622 miles an hour. I think that's probably, I would have been four, I think. And that's probably what captured my imagination. But, you know, I was particularly interested, obviously, in the British land speed record holders. And there have been, you know, there have been a few. That Malcolm Campbell, Henry Seagrave, George Easton, John Cobb, obviously, Donald Campbell, Richard Noble, Andy Green. But, I mean, of them all, Cobb is the one that I always found most fascinating because he was just like, if you looked at him, you'd never think for a moment that he was ever the fastest man on earth. You'd think he was a provincial accountant, or maybe a, you know, I suppose he could have been a high court judge. I mean, he was this incredibly big man, big bloke, you know, not just in height, but in physique, bear of a man, but incredibly quietly spoken, quite serious, very considered. And he just decided to go and do incredible. I mean, because he was so big, he could never sort of fit into Grand Prix cars. So he never had any history of doing that. I think he did do Le Mans once. Can't remember what in or where he came. But he became famous for going around Brooklands in his 24-litre Napier Railton, which still exists today in a very original form, still owned by the Brooklands Museum. I have driven it, not quite as fast as he went in it, but maybe I'll tell that story another time. But he broke the outright Brooklands lap speed, the outer circuit record in 1935 at 143 miles an hour in that thing. With the car by no means always on the ground. As anyone who's seen the post on Instagram, you know, there's a photograph of this car completely off the deck, probably at a thick end of 150 miles an hour on those skinny little tires. I mean, the man had at the heart of a lion. And then once he'd sort of done that, he turned his attention to the land speed record, and he built this extraordinary, with Reed Railton, he built this extraordinary thing called the Railton Special, a teardrop land speed record breaker powered by two V12 Napier aero engines, which was all two completely separate powertrains. So the front engine drove the front wheels and the rear engine drove the rear wheels, which actually made synchronizing things a lot better. And then him and George Easton in the 30s had this incredible duel, egging each other on to go faster and faster. And then after the war, 1947, he'd fiddled with the car a bit, gone back, and became the first person to travel across the surface of the planet at over 400 miles an hour. He set a land speed record of 394 in 1947. Wasn't broken for 17 years. I mean, actually, technically 16, because Craig Breedlove did go quicker in 1963, but back then jet cars weren't recognised. So the actual land speed record went to Donald Campbell. So Donald Campbell, if anybody doesn't know, broke the land speed record in 1964, but he was never the fastest man on Earth. But Campbell broke Cobb's record, which was fine. But Cobb, having got through that 400-mile-an-hour barrier, and he set an average of 394, he then thought, well, done land, what's next? Well, clearly water. And he built this jet boat, powered by an engine from a Comet airliner called Crusader. And he went after the water speed record. I find the entire story, there's a book out about it, which I haven't read yet, but I'm going to buy and have a look at, about the entire Crusader attempt. And it is just terribly sad, because it was all filmed, and you know that you can go on the internet and you can see footage of him with the Queen Mother 2 days before he died, showing her around the boat and everything else. And actually, just because of the way that he holds himself and what he wears and the look on his face, you can just get an impression of the kind of man that he was, and you can see him strapping himself in for his final. I mean, I find the entire thing terribly emotional, and then honking off across the lock, and you know, his first run was really, really fast. He'd had a go a few days earlier and had done one, I think it went in one direction at 200 miles an hour, but for some reason the return run was slow, so he was cheesed off about that, and he went out and he did his outbound run, and that was over 200 miles an hour, and he was coming back and he was doing a lot more than 200 when he hit the wake of something. There was some control boat, there was some somebody in some boat who shouldn't have been there, had left some ripples on the lake. And at that sort of speed, in that sort of boat, which was, you know, absolutely on the edge of instability all the time. You know, if you didn't have anything other than a glass finish to, you know, then... And, you know, and the tragedy is 15 years later, it happened to Donald Campbell again on Coniston Water, in his Bluebird jet boat. But he hit his own wake. Campbell died because he was so keen to get the thing done. He'd been up there for so long and he'd had a really good outbound run. And as you know, you have to turn around within the hour and go back the other way. But he had plenty of time. But I just thought he just thought, why wait, just go back. And Campbell hit his own wake, which was awful. Cobb didn't. Cobb was meticulous. Cobb planned everything. I mean, he was a real, real thinker, as well as one of the bravest people who ever lived. You know, and that was that. He had the accident. It was unsurvivable. They got his body out very quickly, but Crusader is still down there. But I only discovered recently, and I cannot believe it, because if you look up here on these shelves, I got so many land speed record books. I didn't know that the people of Glenurquhart, which is the little town on the shores of the lot where he'd stayed and where the measured mile was, had produced this cairn and stuck it at the side of the A82. And if you drive down the A82, unless you know it's there, you won't see it, because there is a little pull-in on the right-hand side if you're going southbound, but it's like three cars long. And it's just a pulley. There's no sign for it anywhere. And, you know, if I hadn't known and I wasn't looking for it, Dario Franchitti was replied and said I've driven past there a thousand times. Didn't even know it was there. And it's one of, you look at it and it looks like, I actually thought he was a beekeeper because it looks like a beehive. I thought that rather sort of fitted the character of the man because what a sort of quiet, gentle thing to spend your spare time doing. But I looked it up. I was convinced. I was telling my wife, no, he was a beekeeper. That's why I can find no evidence of John Cobb being a beekeeper. So if anybody thinks that he was, but no, actually it's a traditional Highland cairn and there are other ones and they look the same, but it's a, the only sadness is that all the foliage has grown up around it. So it used to stand proud, and you can see pictures of it originally. And it's there, and there is the lock behind him. And, you know, it's a proper memorial. And now it's still there, the lock's still there, but there's so much stuff that's grown up between the two. But, yeah, I did that. I've just been on a little sort of tour of Scotland. So I went to the Jim Clark Museum as well in Duns, which I can highly recommend. It's not very big, but well worth... It's probably a 10-minute... If anyone's driving up the East Coast, up the A1 to Edinburgh, it's probably... will add 10 minutes to your journey to go to Duns and see it. And I recommend that to anyone. And then yesterday I was outside the Midland Hotel in Manchester where Rolls is meant to have met Royce for the very first time. So yes, I've had a bit of a sort of, I'm meant to actually, I was just going up to Scotland with my family for a week, but you must make the most of these opportunities and do what pilgrimages you can. So So no, well, John Cobb, great man.
It also, yeah, your tour of sort of notable places this week, last week, has, I suppose it highlights how many exciting and interesting and poignant and significant things happened to do with cars and, you know, things surrounding cars in this country. I mean, it's just so densely packed with those sorts of sites. And
it really is, and that's the point. I didn't try to go to any of these places. I was just sort of there, and I thought, oh, I could go to there, and then I could see that, and then I could do that. And you know, I didn't sort of plot my route and thought, well, first of all, I want to go and see the Jim Clark Museum, then I want to see the Cobb Memorial, and then I'll go to... I mean, they were just, you know, they were just places that happened to be on my way.
Yeah. Oh, that's great, isn't it? Okay, right. We're going to do one more thing just to end this episode of the podcast. I think you're probably feeling slightly trepidatious about this, but a couple of weeks ago, Sebastian Vettel surprised an awful lot of people by being able to name every Formula One world champion in order from 2020 all the way back to 1950. He got them all right. It was an extraordinary feat, actually, and it demonstrates just what a student of the sport he really is.
Did he name them, or did he actually get the year? Because I haven't seen any of this. Did he actually get the years in which...
Well, he named them in order. So, yeah, year by year.
Including himself?
Including himself, yeah.
I haven't seen this.
Which
I need
is
to
bizarre,
go
isn't it?
This is going to go so it's... badly wrong.
Well, okay. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, I thought, I know a man who might be able to do that. So we're going to flip on its head, though, and we're going to do 1950 to 2020.
Yeah, I'll be really good at the early stuff. And then you'll learn so much about what I think about Formula One by just how rubbish I am. I'm never going to be able to do it, but... how long do I just have to do it as fast as I can, or can I just sort of talk
well,
you through it?
Well, you can take your time. But what if you get one wrong? Do you want me to jump in, or do you want to carry on?
Yeah, no, jump in.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, jump in. I'm quite nervous. Okay.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, in your own time, then, starting with 1950.
I don't have to get the cars as well, do I?
No, no, you don't.
Okay, I'll do as many of the cars as I can. Right, so we start obviously with the great Dr. Giuseppe Farina in 1950 with the Alfa 15, that would have been 158 then, because by 1951 it was Fangio. By that stage, the 158 had a Dino rear axle and they called it a 159. Then in 1952 it went to F2 regs and Ascari had the next two in the Ferrari 500, pretty much unchallenged, largely because Fangio had a big off and he missed half of the 1952 season. 1954, obviously Fangio is back and we all remember that for the W1. 196. People forget that he actually won a race at the beginning of the year in a Ferrari, in a Maserati 250F, so that has to contribute to his championship too. 1955, obviously Fangio in the W196. 1956, Fangio in the Did they call it a Lancia or a Ferrari? But it was the Lancia D50. I think they probably called it a Ferrari 801 by that stage, but that's what it was. 1957, Fangio again, and from Maserati 250F. His last win at the Nürburgring, the greatest Grand Prix ever run, many say. 1958, Mike Hawthorn. Bit of a swizz, that one, because he only won one race that season, where Stirling won four, but nevertheless, he won the championship by 1 point. 1959. Well, we're into the mid-engine era now, aren't we? So we're into Jack Brabham in the Cooper, and again in 1960. So we know about that. 1961 was Phil Hill, because Wolfgang Trips got killed at Monza, so Phil Hill in the Sharknose Ferrari. 1962, Graham Hill, obviously, silly me, in the BRM. 1963, Jim Clark in the Lotus 25. 1964, John Surtees, one of the most closely fought championships of all time. Three people went into the last race with a chance of winning it, but he won it in the 158 Ferrari, although I think he also drove the 1512 that season as well. 1965, Jim Clark again in the Lotus. Was it a 25 or a 33? One was a development of the other, probably both. 1966 was Jack Brabham in a Brabham. First time anybody had done that, winning a championship in a car of his own. Making 1967, Denny Hulme in another Brabham. 1968, Graham Hill in the Lotus 49. 1969, Jackie Stewart in the Matra MS80? Not sure. 1970, the one and only posthumous world champion, Jochen Rindt, in a combination of the Lotus 49 and the 72. 1971, Jackie in the Tyrrell Ford 003, I think, for most of the season. 1972, Emma at the time became the youngest world champion. He was only 25, and he did it in the Lotus 72. 1973, Jackie's final championship in the Tyrrell Ford 005 and 006. 1974, Emo again, but this time driving a McLaren M23. 1975, Nicky's first in a Ferrari 312T. 1976, obviously James Hunt in the M23. 1977, it was Nicky again, but this time driving a 312T2. 1978 was Mario. Was it? Yes, it was, in the Lotus 79. 1979 was Jody in the Ferrari 312T4. 1980, Alan Jones in the Williams FW7. 1981 was Nelson Piquet's first. He was in a Brabham. Then Keke, who only won one race that season as well, in 1982 in the Williams. And then 1983 was Piquet again. Okay, so I'm going to take a bit of a pause for breath now. I think we're getting into the Prost era now. So, or is there another Lauda to come? I think there's another Lauda to come. But that was, yeah, that was it. He lost. Lauda won the championship by like half a point, didn't he, in 1980. What was the last one I did? Was that 83? Piquet in 83.
83 was the last one you did, Piquet.
Okay,
yeah.
So, okay, fine. That. So then that's Lauda in 84, and then Prost in 85, and Prost in 86, obviously. Where are we? Take us to. So 87, that's Nelson again. 88 was Ayrton. In the great, in the MP44, 16 races, 15 wins, great battle with Prost. Know about that. And then 89. You see it? 89. Okay. 89. So I'm going to go Prost. And you haven't said anything, so I must be right. Okay, so good. So 1990 was obviously Ayrton again. That's easy. And 1991 was Ayrton. 1992, Nigel. 1993 was Prost's last, wasn't it? So 1994, we then get into the Michael. Benetton Ford 94, Benetton Renault 95. Oh, you're doing my head in. I've been on. Okay. So Michael. Is it Jacques Damon or Damon Jacques? It was Damon Jacques, wasn't it?
It was, well done.
Damon Jack. Okay, fine. And then Mika?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, God. So what does that take us to?
So 98
was Mika, and 99 was Mika. And then it's easy for a bit, because the next five was Michael, and then the two after that was Fernando. So that takes us to 2006.
Seven. 2007.
Well, no, 2007 was Kimi, surely.
Yeah. Okay, so 2007 was next. So yeah, Kimi, 2007. Okay. On you go.
All right, 2008, Lewis. Then I get really bad. 2009. I'm missing one. Because I know it was Vettel in 10. Who was 9?
You'll kick yourself.
Don't say a bloody word. Jensen! Jensen, sorry, Jensen. God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Now I'm going to be rubbish. So it's a combination of Vettel and Lewis with a Nico in the middle every year since. So let me guess. So Nico, I know, was 16. So Vettel did... So 10, 11, 12, 13, Lewis, 14, 15, Nico, 16, Lewis.
And one more Lewis.
Woo!
Well done.
Can I get another lie down now, please? Can I get another lie down now, please?
That looked like a real effort. But bravo, you got it. And you got a lot of the cars right in the
Yeah, but you noticed
well.
I shut up on the cars later on. although, actually, if I thought about it, it's obvious, isn't it? Because it's all because... You know, when was a championship last won by anything other than a Ferrari, a Red Bull, or a Mercedes?
It was the Braun year, but yeah.
So that, I could probably have done that too, couldn't I? Oh well.
I reckon you could have had a good go at it. But there you go. I mean, you said that before we started, you told me that you would do well with the early years and you'd struggle after around 2000. And I think
that's fairly accurate, isn't it?
You were grasping around for the 2009 winner for a little while, weren't you? But you got hold of Jensen Button eventually. There you go. That was really impressive. You pulled it off. Sebastian Vettel managed it. You managed it the other way around. So, bravo.
Okay.
That was a stonking effort.
Okay, we need to do Le Mans winners next.
Okay. All right. Well, that's one for... Wait, it's Le Mans week, isn't it? So maybe we'll do that next week. And yeah, we'll see how you get on.
Okay, only with makes of cars. I can't do drivers.
All right, we'll save that one, and we'll put you to the test again. But yeah,
from 1923.
For now, well done.
But the thing is, if I know you're going to do it, okay. If I promise not to do any prep, but I might think about it a bit, is that okay?
That's okay. That's fine. As long as you don't have it written down in front of you
when you do it,
promise not to do too much swatting up. That's absolutely fine. Good. Well, I enjoyed that.
Who won Le Mans in 1936? Ultimate pub quiz trick question. Who won Le Mans 1936?
Nobody.
Correct! There wasn't one.
Yes. Ah, there you go. Okay. All right. Well, God, I feel tired after that. Never mind you. Well, let's leave that one there. And we will put you to the test again next time. But for now, thank you everybody for listening.
Yeah.
Please rate and review the podcast. Go and download the Intercooler app as well and subscribe. And we'll be back to talk to you again next week.
Look forward to it. All the best.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.